We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also very happy to have back on the program once again David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. And for quite a while now, he's been stopping by on a Friday once a month to talk about investing in money management. And he usually begins by making a few comments, sometimes about the economy, sometimes about a particular topic, something that he thinks would be good for you to know something about. And then we open it up to questions. And it can be about whatever it is he's about to discuss or anything else that has to do with financial planning, money management. If you have a specific question for yourself, you can call in and share your thoughts with Dave, and he'll tell you what he thinks. Questions are certainly welcome. We get things going here by saying good morning. It's good to see you again.
Well, thank you, David, and good morning. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, it's the political season, and many financial advisors and legal professionals are just in a quandary as to what to advise their clients with respect to estate planning and estate taxes. While it is unclear as to the estate tax rates going forward, it is still instructive to review the basic building blocks of a solid estate plan. Therefore, I'd like to briefly take just a few minutes and review a number of legal documents which comprise an appropriate estate plan for many of us. So let's begin by examining the term durable powers. Actually, durable powers refer to two important estate planning documents, and these documents are, well, they're for everyone regardless of what estate tax rates do. They are indeed the health care power of attorney form and the general power of attorney form. Essentially, a health care power form is a legal document in which you appoint another individual to make health care decisions about you if and only if you are unable to make these decisions yourself. Your agent or your appointee is the final decision maker and can even overrule the doctor or the hospital. Therefore, of course, it's important to carefully choose this agent, this appointee. Generally, parents or spouses appoint each other, and siblings who are at least 21 years of age often are backups for parents. It is especially important that elderly relatives have executed this form so that a loved one can make health care decisions in the event of an emergency, or for the purposes of placing a loved one in a long-term health care facility. Everyone needs this document. There really aren't exceptions to this rule. Now, if you're going to give someone the power over your health care, what about power over the money? That's called a general power of attorney. It's the second durable powers form. It also is a legal document under which you appoint another individual, or perhaps even a corporate trustee, to represent you in all financial matters if and only if you are unable to represent yourself. For example, your general power of attorney agent could pay your bills, sell your stocks, pay your rent, and even deal with Social Security. In other words, your agent could do just about anything you are legally empowered to do with respect to your financial affairs. Now, the health care power of attorney gets signed and witnessed. The general power of attorney gets signed by you and actually notarized. A third document, again, which many of us have or should have, is known as a living will. Now, a living will is generally a one-page document which expresses your final wishes as to how you wish to be medically treated in the event that your death, well, it's imminent. Basically, the document says that if death is imminent and it's been certified by a physician, then no heroic measures should be taken to artificially postpone that moment of death. The living will does not appoint another individual to make health care decisions about you. Rather, it is your final expression of how you wish to be treated given the circumstances. So these are sort of three preliminary estate planning documents. They have nothing to do with conveying your assets, whether it is real property or personal property. Again, three preliminary documents important to have: healthcare power of attorney, general power of attorney, living will. As far as the healthcare power of attorney and living will, you can download them very easily on the internet. You can go to any local medical clinic, hospital. They have the statutory forms. The general power of attorney, if you simply download Illinois general power of attorney form, it'll pop up and you'll be able to utilize that form as well. Naturally, if you get involved in more complex estate planning with an estate planning lawyer, he or she will also have these forms and will insist that they be updated and signed off on. All right. Now, let's sort of briefly review a document. Well, it's really forming the basis of an estate plan. Sometimes it's called a will. Sometimes it's called a pour-over will, P-O-U-R, pour-over will. This legal document, as I mentioned, often forms the basis of your estate plan. In a nutshell, the will appoints, first of all, an executor to wind up the affairs of your estate pursuant to your written wishes. So this will expresses your written wishes. You appoint someone that says, hey, follow these written wishes. Now, the executor is generally not the lawyer. Rather, it is often a relative or, in some cases, a corporate trustee. Very frankly, I prefer an individual over a corporate trustee. The most important provision of a will for young people with children is a guardianship provision, providing guardianship instructions if the decedent has children who have not yet reached the age of majority, who is going to look after my children? So for our older listeners who have married children and they have grandchildren, they should have a will because the way you deal with guardianship is through your will. A second important provision often in this kind of will basically says, hey, all assets that are not currently titled in my trust should be retitled and redistributed in my trust pursuant to the trust instructions. Now, remember that a will is a public document. So if you put all the details of your estate plan in a will, once that will is filed over at the local courthouse in what is generally referred to as the probate division, why, my goodness, anyone and their uncle or their aunt has access to that document. All they have to do is request it and pay the photocopying fee, and they can read to their heart's content everything that is in your will. So remember that a will is a public document. So very, very many people try to make that document as general and as innocuous as possible, and then having a provision that says, oh, by the way, everything is distributed according to my trust. A trust is a private document, and there is no public access to a trust document. Often, as part of an estate plan, an attorney will draw for you a form called a revocable or revocable living trust. It's very common as part of an estate plan. Essentially, a revocable living trust is nothing more than a written instrument. By the way, it can be revoked or amended at any time prior to the death of the individual. A trust, it's sort of what it sounds like, is a legal instrument authored by an individual. In other words, you want to have one of these things. So if I want to have a trust, I go to a lawyer and say, I'd like to have a trust drawn. The individual who wants the trust drawn is usually referred to as the grantor. So the author of the trust, if you will, is the grantor. And the grantor, let's say I want one of these things, appoints another individual, or in some cases a corporate entity, to act as a trustee. So every trust has someone who wants this, called a grantor. Every trust has someone who is appointed, called a trustee. And the trustee is basically charged with the responsibility of carrying out the provisions of the written trust document. Now, all trusts are drawn for someone's benefit, and the individuals who benefit from the provisions of the trust are called beneficiaries. So now we've got a grantor, we've got a trustee, we've got a beneficiary, and finally, the trustee needs something to administer, either real property, personal property, houses, stocks, bonds, securities, cash, farmland. And the legal term for the stuff that the trustee administers is called corpus. So it's really not very complicated, and I'm simply trying to demystify those forms for you. Now, in 2009, going back to 2009, it was possible that by incorporating a revocable living trust into an estate plan, two married individuals could leave a minimum, get this, of $7 million estate tax-free to their children, to other beneficiaries, or other non-charitable beneficiaries. Anything that you give away at your death to a charity, to a recognized charity, obviously is estate tax-free. Now, it may well turn out that the 2009 estate tax rules may be reinstated, at least for 2011 and thereafter. The jury is really out as to what is going to happen in 2010, because currently, at least folks like George Steinbrenner's relatives are hoping that there is going to be no change in the 2010 rules where there is no federal estate tax. But it's unclear as to what Congress is going to do, certainly nothing until the elections are decided and Congress apparently comes back to work. So we'll stay tuned and see. But it appears, regardless of what is going to happen, it's time very, very soon to make certain that you have the correct documents for your own estate planning purposes. All right, let's change directions for just a moment and examine our couch potato portfolio. Of course, our portfolio can be fully accessed on the WILL website. I believe we click on Focus 580, and then we click on Couch Potato Portfolio, and it should show up. It was just updated this morning through last night's close. Recall that the portfolio is composed of really 8 different Vanguard index funds. Now, through last night's close, the portfolio, and this is a stock portfolio, year-to-date, is ahead approximately 11.1%, as compared to our benchmark, and that's the S&P 500 index, which is also up. That's a positive 6.8% year-to-date. So our diversified portfolio continues to outperform our benchmark by just a little bit more than 4%, and that's significant. That's significant. So at least thus far in 2010, a diversified strategy is paying off. Specifically, what is really moving that portfolio this particular year are the REIT indexes. They're up well over 20% for the year, the Vanguard REIT Index, as well as the Emerging Markets Index. That's up over 15%. Now, I believe that when we get together in January, I am going to be changing the overall asset allocation model. And that's because in the Vanguard Total International Index, if you click on Vanguard and look at their Total International Index, they have broadly increased their exposure to the emerging markets. About 20 to 25% of the funds now invested in that particular index have moved into emerging markets. In the olden days, that was between 7 and 10%. So I have to look at that carefully at the end of the year to see if we are overweighted in the emerging markets index, because about 30 cents of every dollar we're investing internationally. So there may be some changes coming when we get together in January. But bottom line, at the moment, the portfolio is up about 11%, the S&P up a little less than 7%. So this has been a very positive month. In fact, about the last 60 days, quite positive for U.S. and international stocks, despite all of the issues facing both our economies and many of the other sovereign countries, especially in Western Europe. So there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to tackle questions on questions that might come as a result of my remarks or certainly whatever else is on our listeners' minds.
All right. David Sunow, he's clinical professor of finance here at the U of I in the College of Business. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We do these shows to talk about investing in money management. And as Dave says, you have a question, you can call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. If it would be long-distance call, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a caller and also have an email. So let's do the caller first. And we'll go to Desplaines up in the Chicago area, line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. Dr. Sino, if I could, I wanted to say at the moment with IRAs and CDs, ultra-conservative situation, but with those two, I list the beneficiary in the case of my death. However, I do have the house. Should I be looking at more than a will and perhaps a trust because of the house, simply because to cut down on the amount of time that my wife, in the event of my death, would have an easier time with the home?
Well, that's a great question. If you hold your home in joint tenancy with a right of survivorship.
No, I don't.
Do you hold the house in JTRE, joint tenancy by rights of entirety?
It's all mine, yeah.
Okay. Well, if it's simply yours and you have a will, then it's going to go through the probate process. If your estate is not dramatically large, then it may be very smart to retitle the house jointly in both of your names. That way, if you predecease your spouse, then the house, by operation of law, your undivided interest in that house passes automatically by operation of law. It bypasses the probate process. It bypasses your estate plan. So most folks who are married generally have their home in some type of joint ownership form.
And if I may add one other thing, which I regret not mentioning to you, that might change your answer. That's very clear what you've said so far. However, it is a second marriage, and I do have children as well, and typically it's
okay.
I divide up my earthly goods.
Okay.
In some
Understood. Understood. Yeah. Now, with respect to life insurance policies, beneficiary designations on IRAs, 401ks, et cetera, that also bypasses wills and trusts.
Yeah.
Right? That goes directly to the named beneficiaries.
Yeah.
So back to the house. You have a variety of choices. One choice, of course, is to add other people to the title, but that is a bit problematic because if those other people, for example, had debt problems, credit problems, a creditor could then come back against the asset and tie it up. So lots of time, parents don't like the idea of jointly titling assets with children because of potential credit problems down the road. So another choice would be to have a trust, a very simple trust, and that trust could then lay out what assets go to whom, who are going to be the beneficiaries, and then you would simply retitle your house into your revocable trust. And as long as you are living, you control that asset. You can always change it. You can always tear up the trust. So in this particular case, in a second marriage with children who might be the ultimate beneficiaries, you could discuss with an attorney a simple trust. It's not real complicated. You're still in total control. And then the house itself would be conveyed by deed to the name of the trust. And then you've avoided probate, you've taken care of your children, and you're still in total control.
Yes, because I pretty much would like to do something like 50% of the value of the equity in the house for the wife, and maybe 25 for the children.
Right.
And upon my death, does that mean my wife has to move out?
No, absolutely not. Oh. Absolutely not. You can set up the trust so that she has either a life estate in the house, et cetera, or they, three of them, could agree on what to do. That's an easy thing to accomplish through a trust document.
Well, thank you for telling me about the ease of it. It's something I need to get on, and pardon me, I've delayed on doing something other than what I've got now, which is a simple will. So,
yep, you need to make a change then. And like all of us, we seem to procrastinate about estate planning.
Yeah,
that's a number one problem, not only among yourself, but among all of us.
I see. And typically you would work that out through an attorney.
Absolutely. You need an attorney to do that. Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you again, Bert.
All right.
My pleasure.
Good. Thank you. Well, I have an email here, and let me share that question with you. We have someone who says that that they often pay ahead on their mortgage by $100 or so a month. And I'm assuming that what they're meaning is they're paying extra on the principal.
Extra on the principal.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the question is, but would we be better served in the long term to take that money that we're using to pay ahead and investing it in some sort of IRA or to put it in one of our work retirement savings options? They go on to add that their mortgage was recently refinanced at 3.67% on a 15-year fixed term.
Okay. I love the interest rate at 3.67.
Sounds pretty good.
And sounds amazingly good. And so they were at the low on the mortgage rates. 15 years today is still a little bit higher than 3.67. So I applaud if that indeed is the rate. Further, it may well be that they are also itemizing. If they are itemizing, then that interest rate is even lower after tax. So my view is a 15-year amortization schedule is a rapidly paying down amortization schedule. And one of the things that you want to do in a Roth IRA, an IRA, some other kind of investment, is build some liquidity. So if it were me, because 3.67 is a great rate, I would probably be taking that additional $100 a month and looking at where I would invest it. I wouldn't be investing it probably in just a plain old vanilla CD or just a plain old vanilla money market, because then I'd be better off paying down my house at 3.67 because I can't earn that inside a money market or a savings account today. Maybe we were in a tenth of a percent or two-tenths of a percent. So I would likely dollar cost average, it's a great strategy, of 100 or 200, whatever it is a month, into a diversified mutual fund or two, and probably an equity mutual fund unless you are already heavily weighted in equities. So in this particular case, because we have this very, very impressively low interest rate, I think, and you're already on a 15-year amortizing schedule, which is a rapid payoff for most Americans, then I would urge you to take that other money and invest it. And if you are eligible for a Roth IRA example, I would do something inside a Roth IRA, probably some type of equity vehicle or investment.
Okay. Hope that helps. Next caller is in Charleston. We'll go there. Line four. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I just recently retired, took early retirement.
Congrats.
Yay. Very exciting. And my husband and I are thinking about buying a vacation home in California. It would be buying with his sister. I have money in TIA CREF, and I also get CSRS, and my husband has money in TIA CREF, and then we have money through a brokerage firm. And my question is, if we decide to, say, do a $50,000 down payment, would it make more sense for me to take a lump sum out of TIA CREF, or would it make more sense for me to go into my stocks, our stocks, at our brokerage firm?
Well, first of all, it would make a lot more sense to take it out of the brokerage firm.
Okay.
Because the worst thing that can happen to you at the brokerage firm is that you would, if you have a gain on those stocks, at least this year, this year, you would be taxed at a maximum capital gains rate of 15%.
Okay.
And since you're a resident of the state of Illinois, the capital gains rate for Illinois state income tax is 3%. Ooh. So the maximum is 18%. So if you pulled $50,000 out, and let's just pretend that your tax basis, in other words, you had originally purchased those investments at $40,000.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a $10,000 capital gain.
Mm-hmm.
That would cost you $1,800 in tax.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you wait till next year to sell the brokerage account
mm-hmm.
and sell these stocks, there may well be a higher capital gains rate, 20%.
Ah.
Ah. So you might be better off selling those positions this year,
mm-hmm.
warehousing them in a money market fund until you get ready to purchase your investment in California. And I'm going to talk about that in just a moment as well.
Okay.
If you take money out of TIA CREF, for example, I presume that that TIA CREF money is retirement money that has not yet been taxed.
Correct.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you pull that money out and you will be taxed at your ordinary income tax rate.
Uh-huh.
So if you added suddenly $50,000 to your current income, your current retirement, your husband's income,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't take you very, very long to get at least into a federal tax bracket marginally of 25%.
Right.
So, for example, once you hit $68,000, and you'd be well in advance of that, because if you took $50,000 out, you'd be way over that, 25% bracket in 2010 is estimated to be somewhere for folks who make $68,000 to up to about $137,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we'd be paying at 28%, 25 federal, and possibly, depending on whether or not, depending, you might not pay the state of Illinois because typically state of Illinois doesn't charge income tax on retirement, but you'd be at a significantly higher tax rate,
mm-hmm.
right? So having said that, now, if you do pull $50,000 out of your brokerage account, would that be stocks, or do you have fixed income as well in there?
It would be stocks.
Okay. So if you are happy with your current asset allocation, what you might do is you then look at your TIA CREF positions, and if you are going to take $50,000 out of the brokerage side in stocks, you might then reposition some of your TIA CREF money back more into stocks. In other words, if you have fixed income, which you do because you have TIA,
mm-hmm.
as well as CREF, CREF is the stock side, TIA is the fixed income side,
mm-hmm.
then to preserve enough exposure in the equity markets, you might decide to reposition some of the TIA CREF money simultaneously. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So you do it in a market neutral way. So if I sell next week on Wednesday $50,000 of stocks, I also buy $50,000 of mutual funds from my TIAA into my CREF.
Mm-hmm.
Follow me?
Mm-hmm.
So you haven't really changed your overall stock market position.
Right.
Okay, now that, all right, so that answers that.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's talk about this vacation home business
yeah.
in California.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And then going out when you're in retirement and getting a loan, apparently.
Right.
Where are you thinking of buying?
In Sonoma Valley.
That's a nice area. Yeah. I'm very happy. Professor Inge and myself yeah. will be delighted
we'll visit.
To visit
exactly.
and sip a little, well, I guess, lemonade
exactly.
on the porch
yes.
At Sonoma. So you're talking somewhere between a $200,000 and $400,000 investment?
Yes.
Okay, that you are.
Mm-hmm.
That's and I hope, you know, that you are in a position to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to dissuade you from doing that. What I would suggest to you is not to buy a condominium or a townhouse.
We were not planning on
okay.
that.
Okay. Condominiums and townhouses are fraught with problems from an investment side, from a second home side, from a financing side, from the hassle of just dealing with people in a condominium development. And there's all kinds of new rules and regulatory rules Lord knows California has enough regulatory rules to last us a lifetime. So I'm at least pleased to hear that you're thinking about a house as opposed to a condominium or a townhouse.
Okay.
All right? So that you're on the right track. How are you planning to title this investment?
You mean in terms of...
Well, you're getting together with your another with part of your family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. How are you planning to hold this investment?
Well, it would be in both of our names.
Okay. So there is a question, and I think you need to probably visit with your attorney.
Okay.
Who can suggest to you different ways of holding this second home.
Okay.
All right? So it might be something called tenancy in common. That may be a possibility. It might even be in the form of some type of limited liability company.
Okay.
So there are different ramifications and tax ramifications of how you want to handle it. If you want to write off the interest and you want to write off half the real estate taxes as a second home, mm-hmm. discuss with your attorney the possibility of holding this as tenants in common.
Okay.
Tenants in common. Okay, that's my advice.
Wow. A lot of food for thought there and a lot of research.
Okay, and good luck. And don't forget us if you move to Sonoma.
All right.
All right.
Thank you for the call. We have a couple of people here in line, and I have some emails I want to try to do and try to get everybody in. Dave Suno is with us. He's on the program once a month, always a Friday, and we talk about money management and personal finance. He is a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. And we have a couple of people here on the phone. They're both in Urbana, so let's go there. We'll go to Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I don't know which line I
am. Oh, I'm sorry. You're on line one. Go ahead. You're on.
Okay. Hi. I have investments with a broker. I've switched from TIA Aircraft to the broker some years ago, and I have a money market with them that is not getting anything, very, very almost nothing. And the others, you know, are doing okay. But I'm wondering, how could I go about getting a better money market? Because with TIA Aircraft, I used to get much better returns.
Well, you are, shall we say, welcome to the group. National money market rates are practically nothing. You're probably earning about 0.1% to 0.2%
Yes.
Is that what you're earning?
Yes.
So you are just part of the overall national crowd because money markets typically are composed of short-term IOUs, short-term treasury instruments, which are paying practically nothing, short-term corporate IOUs, which are called commercial paper, which are also paying practically nothing. So as a result, in terms of just shopping a better money market, that doesn't work. All right? So you're not going to go out and find a significantly higher rate of return in another money market. You would have to go into either a very short-term bond fund. And when I talk about short term, I'm talking about something with a maturity of those bonds of 6 months to 24 months or less. But there will be some principal volatility. In other words, your principal isn't guaranteed, even though bond funds have done quite nicely over the last 12 to 18 months. That's a choice. Or simply getting on the telephone and shopping certificates of deposit. And interestingly enough, in the Champaign-Urbana community, if you really, really search, often there are many local credit unions and other banks and financial institutions are insured, and they offer, take a look at 5-month CDs, 7-month CDs. If you're willing to tie your money up for that period of time, often they are paying 2, 3, even 4 times what a typical money market will pay.
Uh-huh. Good advice. Thank you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Right. Very good. Thank you.
By the way, though, I put my Social Security into this money market. I have it sent there. I couldn't do that with these other short-term investments, could I?
Not in terms of a CD,
no,
but you could always just simply move the money.
Right. Sure. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right.
Much.
Very good.
Bye.
On to another caller. This is line number 2, and this is also Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was calling in response to what you talked about with the woman getting a second home in California.
Yes.
And the condo. And I wanted to know, you mentioned two categories, condo and...
Townhouses.
Townhouses. How that, does any of that apply to Urbana or Champaign?
No, I don't think so. What has happened in California is California now requires each condominium development and townhouse development to annually do what is called a reserve audit. In other words, someone has to come in and analyze whether or not the association is holding enough money in reserve to deal with potential earthquake insurance, mm-hmm. deal with all of the things that need to be fixed up in the association, etc. And very, very often, these are very aggressive types of audits, which basically come to the conclusion there is not enough money in reserve. And then under the California rules and regulations, what happens is that the association is forced, if you will, to provide special assessments, okay, mm-hmm. to institute special assessments so that these reserves are brought up to snuff and they can become very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. Also, there are complicated rental rules in these associations.
Mm-hmm.
There are complicated rules about changing bylaws, and it can become a nightmare, especially for someone who is an investor. If you're an investor, it's very, very difficult to deal often with these condominium associations because a lot of these folks don't want rentals,
yeah. And
that can impact the market value of these properties. So I have counseled at least my personal clients, to be very, very careful about thinking about purchasing a townhouse or a condominium, especially in the California marketplace.
Now, how much of what you said, I was assuming it was all related to California. How does that, how are those rules in Illinois?
Well, in Illinois, I think they're much more reasonable, much more reasonable.
Because one of my concerns would be the fees.
Well, obviously, one of the most important things that you can do before you purchase a condominium or a townhouse is to very, very carefully read what are called the CC&Rs,
mm-hmm.
the Covenants, Conditions, and Restrictions of Record. That will tell you, for example, can you have pets? Okay? Condominium association can say no pets. They can't say no children anymore, but they can say no pets. And they can have a dramatic impact for a whole lot of people. That's just one example.
Okay.
And even if they allow pets today, through the bylaws, through a vote, that could be changed. The associations can say, sorry, you can't rent, right?
Okay.
Or if you are going to rent, you have to rent for a minimum of 6 to a 12-month period. These can all have impacts on values.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to read these bylaws and these CC&Rs very, very carefully. And then, before I would buy a condominium, I would want an assessment that basically says, hey, what shape is the overall association in financially?
Okay.
Are we going to be facing any special assessments? Now, you may be able to get this information through your realtor, but I would certainly make certain that I investigated it to my satisfaction. So those are three areas before I would buy a condominium or a townhouse. And there are wonderful condominiums and townhouses available in the Champaign-Urbana area.
That I would be investing only in the sense that I would be living in it.
Okay.
But you said the CC&Rs and have a financial investment, but you said there were three. And
well, the CC&Rs, the bylaws.
Oh, the bylaws.
And
okay.
Then I would ask to, I would investigate specifically with the president of the association or whomever it is, are there any special assessments
okay.
contemplated?
That's it.
Got it?
Yes. Thank you. I love this show.
All right. Well, thank you.
Take care.
We have about 10 minutes left with David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. And we do the show once a month on Solace on a Friday to talk about money management, and your questions are welcome. I have an email here I want to get in. The listener said they heard you talking with a previous caller about placing a house in a revocable trust with the surviving spouse with a 50% interest and the kids each getting 25%. So the question is this: after the death of one of the spouses, since the trust is revocable, could the surviving spouse change the original distribution to the house and say then place themselves, or, you know, maybe there are other children, and be a second set of children, and then cut out the original beneficiary?
Oh, my. Oh, my. What a wonderful question. Once the grantor, in other words, the person who makes the trust, dies, that revocable trust becomes irrevocable. And those provisions are cast, so to speak, in stone.
All right. So it's the deal is that the person who makes the trust, while they're alive, if they want to make a change,
absolutely.
They can. But once they have passed,
it's over.
It's done.
It's done.
All right.
It's done. It's irrevocable. And it stays irrevocable unless one of the provisions, of the operating provisions, is void against public policy. And in this case, this would not be void against some public policy. In other words, if I had a trust document and said, oh, at my death, I want to leave all of my money to organized crime, that would be void against public policy.
Okay.
All right.
Also, in this particular case, say if you're going to do this, the listener is wondering how the house should be titled.
Well, what happens is you first establish a trust. So, for example, you would have the David Inge Trust under agreement dated October 15th, 2010. Once that trust is signed, and you sign essentially as the grantor, and interestingly enough, often while you are alive, you are also the trustee. You can be both. Now you have a written trust document. After the trust document is in existence, you then have a deed prepared. So the deed would say, David Inge, I hereby convey to the David Inge Revocable Trust.
Yeah.
And then it gets recorded at the courthouse.
So the trust is the...
is now the title
now
holder.
The title holder.
Exactly.
Right. One other, and I want to especially ask this just because it's been in the news so much, and hopefully maybe we can deal with it fairly quickly. The caller also wonders about selling gold. She says that she has a lot of U.S. mint proof sets purchased in the 90s. She wonders, is it time to sell them, and then where does she go to sell them?
Well, she could certainly go to a local dealer. We have local dealers in Champaign-Urbana, and they could look at those particular proof sets or mint sets, and there is a difference between proof sets and mint sets because most of those, what we're talking about is silver content. And silver now is at a very, very high level, just like gold. So she would need to actually take them locally, and a local dealer, and they're all very reputable, would be happy to explain what the value of those sets are and what the market value in terms of if she wanted to sell them.
Okay.
So I think probably just doing something locally would make the most sense.
All right. We have several callers here. We'll try to get one or two. St. Joe is the next in line. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is a estate planning question. And my question is, what is the Illinois maximum estate value to avoid probate?
Well, you can avoid probate on any amount of money. In other words, let's say that you had your estate was a $10 million life insurance policy payable to David Inge. That avoids probate. You could have a $100 million IRA, a $200 million 401k. In other words, if all of your assets are titled in a trust, if all of your assets are titled directly to named beneficiaries, you avoid probate. So it is not a dollar amount. There is a small estate affidavit that one can file to avoid probate, and that is that if you have an estate in Illinois, I believe the number is $50,000 or less, and the person who died does not own any real estate, then you can avoid probate even if everything is just titled in the decedent's name. And you can actually file this small estate affidavit. So let's, for example, say that I passed away. The only thing in my name was a $30,000 certificate of deposit. Ordinarily, that would go into probate, but if my representative files an affidavit on my behalf, then that affidavit can be presented to the bank. The bank can accept that affidavit and then convey the CD pursuant to that affidavit.
Okay. Okay, I think I understand. And what is the Illinois current tax rate on estates?
You know, I'd have to look that up. I've forgotten. I don't have that off the top of my head. You could Google that. You could say Illinois estate tax rate, and I just simply don't have that off the top of my head. That's a great question.
Okay, fine. Thanks a lot.
All right. To Champaign. Next caller, line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
I just tuned in, so you might have covered this already. The last couple of years, it has been possible for holders of IRAs and 403Bs and things to direct the minimum required distribution directly to a 501c3. I wonder if anything like that in effect this year, or is it likely to be?
Well, that rule basically, as I understand it, is no longer in effect.
Uh-huh.
Whether it is going to be reinstated is anybody's guess as part of the congressional rule changes. So now what you would have to do is you would have to take that minimum distribution according to minimum distribution rules, then take the money, essentially, and convey it. It may turn out to be just about the same thing if you get a full itemized deduction for that charitable contribution. But what often happens is when people itemize, they fall into the alternative minimum tax rules. And in a sense, they're really not getting the full benefit of all of their itemized deductions.
Yeah,
so it depends. Do you fall into that situation?
I have no chance of being in alternative tax situation.
Okay. Okay. Do you itemize, though?
Yes.
Okay. So then you could certainly make that itemized payment to the charities of your choice.
All right. Thank you, Connie.
My pleasure.
All right. And another caller, line 3, Urbana. Hello.
Hi. What if you had a trust was set up for you and you had $100,000in assets, and the trust was set up, and then you were told that IRAs can't be in a trust, and all of your money is in IRAs, except for a small amount in money market and $2,000 in mutual funds. And you paid the lawyer to set up the trust. What can you do? The lawyer says he didn't realize. I thought you had $100,000. He said.
Well, there isn't a whole lot you can do, and it doesn't make a great deal of sense to make the beneficiary of your IRA your trust, because that just puts an additional layer on it, and you have to be very, very careful, because when people do make the beneficiary of their IRA a trust, they can run into, at least for their beneficiaries, certain income tax consequences that otherwise would be avoidable. So in your particular case, I'm sorry to say that there really isn't a whole lot that you can do.
So I was told to make the trust the contingent.
Yes, that's all right.
That's all right.
That's okay. That's exactly what people do if they have a trust.
Okay.
In other words, they generally make children, whoever they want to benefit, they are the primary beneficiaries. But in the rarest of events, if none of those beneficiaries were alive at the time of your death or my death, then a trust would be what is called the contingent or secondary beneficiary.
Yeah, and that's okay.
Yes, that's okay.
All right.
That's okay. So it's not completely lost.
Have you ever heard of this being done by anybody? Is such a stupid thing being done before?
Well, I think that sometimes people have trusts prepared and they don't really need them. So one of the acid questions obviously is, do I really need a trust? And that depends on the nature of your assets and what you want to accomplish.
I see.
So it happens. But don't feel too badly, because, again, you at least have it covered as the contingent beneficiary.
Okay, and that's a good thing?
That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Okay.
So that's a positive thing. And I presume that you have these other preliminary estate planning documents, like a health care power and general power.
Yes.
You have that.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, good. Good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. You were talking in the beginning about the fact that you can download standard documents for living will, for power of attorney, for health care, and I think actually also for general.
Well, the general power of attorney, the health care power of attorney, and a living will.
Those things.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, one could also go to an attorney.
Absolutely.
And have them prepare those.
Absolutely.
And I guess if you wanted just to be sure all the T's were crossed and I's
absolutely
dotted, that might not be a bad thing to
do. Exactly.
But I guess, so should one be feel sure that if you do this for yourself, there are not going to be any problems?
Well, let me explain. The health care power of attorney form and the living will form, those statutory forms are pretty darn standard.
Okay.
You can pick those up at any medical clinic, any hospital. And in fact, if you are going to have major surgery, they may insist – that these forms are in existence, and certainly the health care power of attorney, before they will even perform major surgery. In other words, who do we ask if there is some issue? Mm-hmm. So those forms are very, very standard. They're easy to fill out, and they get witnessed. The general power of attorney, while it can be downloaded, there are additional paragraphs that can be added to that particular form. And again, it is witnessed, it's notarized, etc. So I frankly feel more comfortable, if I was going to review my overall estate plan, is to have my law firm, my attorney, look at those documents to make sure that they've been properly updated. Certainly the general power of attorney form.
Yeah, okay. And the other thing, just real quick, maybe some people are surprised when they heard you talk about the couch potato portfolio, that a couple of the things that really have been doing well, emerging markets, maybe not so surprising, but REITs, which this is, that REIT is REIT, that stands for Real Estate Investment Trust. And
exactly.
What that means is the money is going into real estate.
Exactly.
I'm sure some people would say, real estate? Well, we thought everything at the bottom had fallen out of real estate.
Well, and this is really very interesting that you bring it up, because I have asked this same question, and that is, REITs really are commercial real estate, not residential
okay.
real estate.
You're
so that's number one.
Office buildings.
Office
and
buildings,
like
warehouses,
that.
And mostly multifamily apartment complexes. Now, multifamily apartment complexes are doing very, very well overall. Office buildings, not so great. Hotels, not so great. And part of the boost in REITs is due to the fact that it now looks like a lot of the lending and a lot of the mortgages that are coming due on these REITs are going to be able to be refinanced. So this is more of a snapback to the fact that people were very concerned that there were going to be massive defaults in the commercial real estate industry. It now looks like banks are refinancing. They're actually reducing outstanding loans on a number of these projects. And as a result, that represents the real snapback in REITs.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, I just talked with a senior executive at Tishman Speyer, which is a huge, huge global real estate firm. In fact, Casey Wold was down at my Finance Academy class for the University of Illinois. And I asked him very specifically, I said, look, I said, these REITs are just flying through the sky. What's going on? And he said, you know, to be honest about it, we're even surprised. Yeah. And I said, should we take profits? And he said, maybe.
Okay. Got to go. Dave Sinnoh, he is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business. Thanks very much.
It's always fun.